listening to the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast. I'm Sarah.
I'm Erin.
And I'm Rachel.
A few of us are a little under the weather, so if we sound a little nasally today recording, it is springtime in Missouri,
so man.
We have, you know, all of the things going around. So
a few of us, so as opposed to a couple of us, a few of us means three, and there's
a couple of
us. Well, no, let's just go ahead and say a few of us here. That seems accurate.
There we go.
It is springtime, so here we are. So today is a book club wrap-up episode. This was a very, I don't even know the words to describe this, maybe the most popular book that we've ever done as a book club book, because I still actually haven't gotten mine from either place that I put it on hold from. I had to get a free Audible account just to listen to this book this time because I could not get it from a library. So Rachel, tell us what we're doing here today and what
It's really nice. We're not used to this, but it's wonderful to be hashtag on trend. I had my eye on this book ever since I had read a review of it, I want to say in World Magazine last fall. And I said, ooh, that seems to speak to a cultural moment. Seems like I was right, because this book is having a cultural moment. We are talking here, of course, about Jonathan Haidt's The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. It is a number one New York Times bestseller. Mm-hmm. Again, kind of unusual for us, but it really speaks to something that has been on a lot of our hearts for rather a long time. And so I was really thankful that this book got written, thankful that it is as good as it is. It really seems to have been done well, and that we were able to discuss it in book club. We had a great discussion last week, 30 plus women came to our Facebook-based asynchronous online discussion where we talked through some of the questions that seemed most pressing and compelling to do with this book, and we'll revisit some of them here today. We did not, of course, hear from Sarah and Erin then, so I'm really keen to hear what you all thought of this book and whether it seemed as incisive to you as it did to me as the mother of teenagers and young people. I had a slightly deeper connection to this book, maybe, but you have eyes, you have ears, you have hearts. Tell me what you thought of the book.
Yeah, I was very excited to read it. I am 11th in line. I started as 16th. There are 20 copies in use and 517 people waiting to read it on Libby. So,
my goodness.
A very popular book. I typically just don't read this kind of book a lot of times when a book is this popular, I'm like, nah, whatever. I'm not a hype person. But my good friend Monica, she just kept sending me screenshots. She's like, this is so good. You have to read this. So that was my inspiration for being very excited to read it. I obviously don't have kids, so this isn't directly applicable to like kids in my own household. But I'm involved with the kids at my church. I have 6 nieces and nephews. My sister-in-law is actually reading the book at the same time. So like we were kind of talking about really randomly. It was not planned. So we were kind of talking through it too. It's informing how they're raising their kids also. And I see a lot of what they talk about in the book with like community and play-based childhood and all that is something that they're doing quite successfully in their little cul-de-sac neighborhood. And that's really just such a gem for them. So Luther and I started reading it on a road trip, and I naively thought that we would just be able to knock it out on the road trip. But however, it is so dense. We kept stopping it to talk about it, and we made it like a third of the way through on our like 10-hour road trip. So we did not finish it. I crammed it last night and this morning. But we kept having to stop and talk about it because there was so much data. And even though Luther's he's like in the middle of Gen X and millennial, like in that tiny little zennial generation or whatever.
Yeah, I know all about that myself, actually. Go ahead.
Yeah. I think you guys are a very similar age. And I am a younger millennial. And even though I'm not in the Gen Z generation that he's talking about, a lot of what he was talking about with childhood in the 90s felt very, very familiar. The safetyism and the shift in parenting. Like I experienced all of that still in my own childhood, even though I'm a little bit older than the generation that he's talking about. a lot of it still felt very familiar. And so a lot of the times I was just pausing the book to be like, oh, I feel seen by a lot of the things that are being talked about in this book. Just like having that lack of freedom in childhood. And really, I mean, no fault to my parents. I'm not blaming them. This was just the culture that happened in the 90s with childhood. So I resonated to a lot of what was going on in the book. And it was just very interesting to read all of the statistics and all of the effect of technology. And even though I'm an adult now, a lot of it was still like I'm revisiting and thinking about how I function with my own devices and in my own communities. And because we're talking about kids and how kids grow and mature, but I feel like a lot of this is still very directly applicable to adults and how we use technology because kids are watching us. I think somebody said that in the group, like he doesn't actually talk a lot about what to do with parents. We are now all addicted to our own phones. So like how do we change that, those habits for ourselves? Because kids are watching us and what we're doing, they're going to model. And so even though I don't have kids in my house, I'm at church around a ton of kids. So do I want to be pulling my phone out all the time when I'm, you know, trying to be in community with other people when I'm in those communities? Probably not. So just a lot. I mean, my brain is still just processing all of it, but just a lot of takeaways and a lot of very real life situations that I'm still kind of processing through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For the benefit of those readers who have not read the book, maybe you are, you know, 21st in line to get it.
Right.
I had expected this book to be a smartphones are bad. And it definitely does say that, you know, that this is not good for kids. But he really traces the story back as what you were saying. According to what you were saying, Sarah, it's exactly right. That he sees the story as starting in the late 80s, early 90s, when parents adopted this safetyism, this idea of sheltering their children from all danger. And we see the rise of helicopter parenting, of overprogramming childhood. And so he sees this as having set us up for real problems with relationships with our digital devices because they keep kids out of physical danger. So you've got the generation of iPad kids. Coming up, and teenagers who may not ever be allowed to set foot out of their homes, but can go anywhere they want on the internet. And he would argue that that's exactly backwards. You should have very tight controls on where they can go online and basically allow them to roam the neighborhoods. That is, if I had his policy prescription in a nutshell, that's what he would say. So yes, that is this book in brief. And obviously, if you have eyes and ears and a heart, you know that the anxious generation is among us and understanding that there is actually a causative, not just a correlative effect. And he's got lots and lots of data and charts and everything to prove, I think very convincingly, that it's not just a coincidence that right around the time all the teenagers got smartphones, they all developed a range of mental illnesses, you know, from video game addictions to various kinds of dysphoria to fill in the blank, anxiety, depression, suicide rates go up, everything. You know, the smoking gun is there and we need to find a better way. And so he spends a lot of the book talking about that better way. So obviously not all of the book anybody is probably going to agree with, but it definitely gets you thinking. So what were you thinking, Aaron, as you read it?
Yeah, so I really appreciated it. I enjoyed it. There was an interesting time in the middle of it where I was like, this book is just, it's making me anxious.
well said.
I'm like reading it. I'm like, this seems like a catastrophe. And I only note it because, Rachel, you are one who is so intentional about your word choices. There was a sense as I was reading it that like this was a disaster upon all of our youth, and it isn't. Like, yes, the rates went up dramatically, but it is not all of them develop mental illness.
No.
To be fair. And like, but you just said at the same time that they all got smartphones, they all got mental illness.
Okay.
And so we
thank you for
about
clarifying.
It
I tend toward hyperbole.
I'm just saying it because like there is this sense of you hear it and you start to start to feel like it's a big problem. It is a big problem. I'm not trying to minimize it at all. But as I was reading it, that was sort of my experience of like suddenly it became this huge thing that was applying to everything. And I had to sort of pause a moment and be like, well, wait a second. Okay, but this isn't, yes, it's a big problem. Yes, it has to be addressed. And I really enjoyed it. I really found the ideas that he proposed thought-provoking and worth considering. Like Sarah, I also don't have children of my own, but I have a lot of kids in my life that I care about. And the idea that they would be facing unprepared some of the things without like the preparation even of just emotional maturity and brain maturity that comes that, you know, that we did have before we started grappling with this, our brains had matured more so. Mm-hmm. And so that was sobering to think about. So yeah, I did really enjoy it. I don't know. It was just also just an interesting experience reading it and getting so caught up into it with the scope of the problem. Mm. So I don't know.
Yes, you're quite right. Not all children.
Yeah. No, this is not a criticism at all of you, Rachel. It was just, it's an interesting.
No, I do like to be careful. I felt myself
having that same experience. And while yours was a slip of the tongue, mine was like a slip of the perspective that I needed to, like, there's what it's two different things, but what you said made me remember the slip of perspective that I had as I was reading it.
Now, I will say that as I read this book and started looking at the full range of mental and emotional effects, I could look back over my own four children and say that in my family, all of them have faced challenges as a result of this phenomenon. And we have been tried to be very careful, be very thoughtful and as wise and disciplined as we could be. And even so, I'm not going to gossip about my children on air. We've faced a lot of troubles. And I think one thing that is really helpful is that he says that young people have faced consequences whether or not they had their own devices.
Yes.
It's simply the entire culture shift.
Yeah.
Whether it's feeling like you're missing out on everything, all your friends are chatting all the time behind your back and you don't participate, or whether you're the one whose life is being completely absorbed into this online matrix of complicated social realities, you're affected. And I can tell you in our family, it's been 100%.
Yeah, I think that's the really challenging part, that it does affect whether or not you have a smartphone, whether or not a kid has one, it still affects everybody. And then that translates into adulthood also. Like, I feel like I can't completely leave social media because I feel like I'm going to be missing out on all the conversations my friends are having. Like, that is a huge reason why I have not been able to disconnect completely from social, because I'm afraid of missing out on conversations that I want to be a part of. So like that struggle is so real.
And it's even worse for teenagers.
Yes.
Because no offense, they don't love us. Not like they used to. No offense, Mom. I really just want to hang out with my friends right now. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I've heard that.
I mean, which is good.
But if all your friends are on, you know, Instagram or Snapchat or whatever, that complicates things a lot.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it sounds like we all needed to read this book and we all benefited from reading this book. Why don't we jump into some of the actual, like, nitty-gritty questions? Are there any from our discussion last week that you each feel like we would like to talk about here today?
Well, the one that I honestly, throughout the whole book, like as it started getting more and more like, this is a disaster feeling, I was like, but what can we do? So the like question four about some of the practical things that could be done to make a difference, to shift the culture to the tipping point away from this screen-based reality. that's really what I once he started getting more into that I really appreciated. And that's probably the one that I'd be most interested to talk more about. Mm-hmm. I saw in the event discussion, in the book club discussion on Facebook, Dawn Peters had shared that a friend of a friend, so sort of a distant thing, they had lost a child to suicide. Mm. And based on their experience, they actually started, that family started working to make some changes in their son's school. Mm-hmm. And that it was more effective than like going the grassroots approach instead of the top-down approach was more effective than Dawn maybe even would have thought, that, you know, taking that approach of starting from the people who it is directly impacting and working to make some changes there can be a very effective approach. I was struck in the book where he was like, you can see about getting a group of parents that you sort of, you're like, as long as we can get these 10 families say that we're all going to agree that we will not give our child a smartphone until this age, then if you can get a group of people together to do that, then you have a small community and you don't have the situation of, or at least it's not as much, your child is not left out completely because they're left out together.
Yes, and that is so true. For us, you know, our life changed so much for the better when we had starting homeschool for the second time and got mm-hmm. connected with a homeschool co-op and a community where the families all had restrictions on screen use. They might have been different restrictions, but nobody's kids were allowed unfettered access to their own devices 24/7.
Yeah.
And so the kids used to like compare notes on who had it worse, which was a real bonding experience. You think your parents are strict.
Yes.
But this just having that community of people.
Experiences of childhood is like complaining about the rules that your parents set.
Yep.
But being in that community where it normalized the idea that kids have restrictions on screen time made their lives so much nicer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Dawn's example and from the book as well, that idea that it really is not, you can make your own policies as a family, but being in a community where you know those policies will be supported, reinforced, and echoed, maybe not exactly, but to know that all of these kids have this in common is huge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was also really struck by, and honestly, with this one, I have no idea if it's possible. Is it pie in the sky, naive? As you mentioned, some of them seemed that way. But struck by the idea of the phone-free schools. Of course, then I was like, but seems like everybody has some sort of Chromebook computer option. So then what is it? Is it device-free schools? I wasn't sure that it wouldn't be as effective to go phone-free, but maybe it would. I don't know. I was struck by it. It seems appealing.
Well, I will tell you, that has been a real change culturally. When my kids were last in public schools, it was assumed that all the kids had smartphones. It was so assumed that during the pandemic, my kids' school in Connecticut, they were required to check into the lunchroom with their smartphones to register where they were sitting so they could do contact tracing if anyone got COVID.
Oh my goodness.
Now, my kids did not have smartphones at that time, nor was I about to buy them a smartphone. And so they just sort of sneaked into the cafeteria and hoped for the best and never got in trouble. But the fact that at that time it was assumed that 100% of students had smartphones and could do this, I found really scary. Now, fast forward, and there are several states, including Virginia, where I live now, that have passed rules that say that public schools are phone free because they realized that kids were having more discipline problems, not learning, mental health challenges, etc. Like this is a huge sea change from just a couple of years difference. And so it is, he's right, change is possible.
Yeah.
It really is, especially when you have incontrovertible evidence that change needs to happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Illinois is currently moving toward banning cell phone use in the classroom, like statewide. So there, I mean, like this stuff is happening in real time. The legislative stuff that he's talking about in the book is actually happening right now, because this book is about a year or two old at this point. So like the things that he's talking about are actually reality.
Yeah.
I think the part that struck me the most out of the what we can do now part was just the emphasis on more play and having a play-based childhood and getting outside more. And I mean, I know from my own personal experience, just as an adult, I mean, I am a much happier person if I am not on my phone and if I go outside every day. I mean, that's my own anecdotal experience. And I can only imagine that it's even more amplified for kids, because kids learn through play, right? And so it was very striking to me that like a solution to this is literally to just kick the kids outside as much as possible and just have them figure stuff out in a, you know, safely risky way of being able to have risks in a way that are not necessarily going to be like life threatening. Like that, we don't want that. But like having that opportunity to figure stuff out as kids, have that the loose parts play was just really interesting to me, of having a playground just full of stuff you can build with. Like I would have loved that as a kid.
Yeah.
But I see that example. Like I mentioned with my brother and sister-in-law, they live in a cul-de-sac neighborhood that is just full of kids. They're all relatively close in age, but there's a lot of kids. And when we were visiting there, every afternoon was just like, go outside, just go outside and play, like whatever, you know, kick the ball around, play hockey, do sidewalk chalk, like just figure it out. And all of the parents are in on this. Like all of the parents are okay with all of their kids being outside without an adult, because they're all at an age where if something happens, they're going to go find a parent and it's fine. Like they don't need an adult supervision. They all the kids know if a car comes down the street, they all yell car and they all know to get out of the street. Like they police themselves as a little tiny community of kids. Like I was reading this book and experiencing this at the same time. But also like that struggle is so real, because the kids come inside and immediately they're like, screens.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
whoa. Like let's do something, like let's go paint or like bake some cookies. Like the options are not outside or screens. Like there are other things that we can do. So like the struggle is still real, but just that emphasis on play and tangentially summer camp. I mean, we talk about summer camp all the time on the Coffee Hour. We talk with summer camp, like how that they build leadership skills, but reading this book, that just solidified that so much more, that summer camp for kids is just, I never went to summer camp and I'm really sad about that.
I know, me neither.
Just reading this book and knowing kids who are now adults who grew up going to summer camp, I can see how that just grows leadership and grows in the independence and the ability to just be your own person as you mature. And it's kind of magical how that time in the outdoors and having to figure stuff out, because if you're climbing trees, like you have to be able to assess risk at some point, and falling out of a tree, knowing what to do if someone gets hurt, like it's just experiences that you don't really get if you don't have that playtime together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do think this was one thing that I had a little bit of anxiety reading the book about, is the amount of freedom that he advocates for young people. Mm. I think he's lacking a little bit of nuance there, and that some of his prescriptions are a little naively optimistic. Speaking from example, you know, I used to encourage and give my young teenagers and like my, you know, think middle schoolers a great deal of freedom, until I realized that as soon as they got out of the house, anything I had said about what they could or couldn't do online went out the door, because their friends all had smartphones. And so they were being exposed to a whole lot of stuff that wasn't good for them. And so it's like, I think he's right that we need to do this, but we do need to make sure we do it together. Because if one family does it and another family doesn't, you know, then we've got this like mix match. It's just, it's complicated.
It's more complicated,
I think, than even he is acknowledging.
Quite
especially
possibly.
For Christian families who are interested in more than just mental health. I found it really interesting. I think I book eared. It's my own book, so I can dog ear the pages, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I bought it. I paid for it. Now I'm going to try and find the one I dog eared. Yes. He says this is his goal. This is what he's going for. We all want our children to become socially competent and mentally healthy adults who are able to manage their own affairs, earn a living, and form stable romantic bonds.
You want a little more than that, though.
This is great. But yeah, my goals for my children involve more than just being a functional adult. I want them to be strong in their faith, to know Christ, to be faithful to him. Mm-hmm. And so that creates a different calculus for me.
Mm-hmm.
That there are certain experiences that the world considers perfectly normal and natural that I would consider not desirable for my children to have. Mm-hmm. And so that changes how I sort of look at some of his prescriptions for the level of freedom that he finds appropriate. I'm still experimenting in my own life to see how I feel. But I think the key for me is finding those communities. Like, I missed the last day of book club because I was at a speech and debate tournament where my children were basically able to live exactly like he describes in the book in terms of having those, you know, peer relationships, that freedom, that responsibility to sort of manage themselves. I was off in a room working with little kids while they were just doing their thing, getting to their rounds on time, you know, policing each other. It was great. And so finding and participating in communities where it is possible to have both freedom and some degree of sort of spiritual boundaries around your time. Like, that's, for me, that's key, is those communities. So I don't know. I'm still thinking through it. Pardon me for thinking out loud.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot, and it's complicated, and it's different in different contexts. It's different depending on what communities you're already plugged into and where you live. And I mean, I wouldn't, if I were a teenager living where I live right now, I wouldn't be able to walk basically anywhere because I would have to cross a 4-lane highway with no sidewalks. So like, it's very complex.
And our neighborhood is technically walkable, but it's a little what some people would consider rough. Like, you know, a block away from us, it's not uncommon to see shopping carts on the side of the sidewalk. You know, it's not exactly the kind of place where I want my kids to free range. Mm-hmm. Like, our immediate block is okay, but, you know, not everyone has the wonderful cul-de-sac situation that it sounds like your nieces and nephews have to sort of just roam in. And so I think we need to make sure that we're understanding that and not forcing a solution that doesn't necessarily work in all contexts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that leads to my question that I wanted to talk about, that Jonathan Haidt says very clearly that he is an atheist. And the book is definitely not Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is question number 3, talking about how the author's atheist worldview colors his treatment of the subject matter. Is there anything missing? Do any of his arguments resonate more strongly because they're made by an atheist? I know evolution, it came up in the comments quite frequently. And I know Luther and I kind of dinged that every time it came up. But yeah. I mean, I was kind of annoyed by it, but also if the author is an atheist, then obviously he's going to talk evolution. I mean, that's just how it works. When you're talking about human development, you're either going to talk about it from a Christian perspective or a non-Christian perspective, which ends up being evolution. So we were just kind of substituting the Christianity in our brains, like just kind of reframing everything from a Christian worldview. Heidi Gaiman and I were having our own little tiny book club with each other as we were both reading the book. And she was giving me some really interesting just perspective on how evolution, like talking about human development from an evolutionary standpoint, also just colors how he thinks about human evolution. So it's not even exactly a one-to-one of just like, oh, I'm going to replace the word evolution with creation instead. It doesn't totally work out that way. There's some other baggage that comes along with evolution that I think you kind of have to work through also because of what we believe about creation and God creating us and what that means for human development. So I know that was a big part of the book. I think the fact that he talks about religious communities being so important for kids, talking about that as an atheist really struck me. Mm. I did not expect him to be so overtly positive about having a religious community and how much that benefits kids as an atheist. That was a very interesting perspective. So I think that argument maybe has a little bit more weight. That was the biggest question sitting in the back of my brain too as I was reading this, because he talks about kids kind of in isolation and in different situations, but just thinking about the different like groups of kids and the different communities that I'm involved in, a lot of them are religious. Like my church, we have a ton of kids and a lot of teenagers. And I was, the whole time I was reading this book, that group of teenagers was in my brain and just kind of thinking about just how I see them go through life and knowing that a lot of, well, I don't actually know anything about their phone usage, but it seems that when they're together, they're typically not on their smartphones. Like they're actually having conversations and they're building bonds together. Yeah. And I think we're very intentional about that at our church. Now, a lot of these kids are also homeschooled, so that also is a different dynamic because different boundaries. I was just kind of questioning if the research that he was doing, how that may be different in religious communities, in churches that have a lot of kids, that have really active youth groups, because it's not just Lutherans that have really active teenage youth groups. Like there's different mm-hmm. denominations that have very active groups that are very intentional about keeping families together and having small groups that know each other really well. And so it was interesting just to hear him talk about those communities do actually insulate this a bit. And I found, as somebody else mentioned this also, he has this whole Substack Beyond Babel that piqued my interest because he actually mentions that one of the articles is about how conservative religious communities tend to have better outcomes than other communities for Gen Z. And I was like, oh, okay. So there is some actual truth to this. So I think we can link this specific article in the show notes. So
yes, we will
find it easier and don't have to Google it and be confused by the title like I was. It took me a hot second to realize I was reading the right article, but because it is not the title I thought it was going to be. But even in the year here, he says that social scientists have done a lot of studies and conservative religious groups. And I mean, he has the example of Orthodox Jewish communities, which are very, very structured communities. Mm-hmm. Orthodox Christian communities are similar. That kind of community, because it has more boundaries typically and more structure to it, and also the values typically are a little bit different from other communities, that insulates, and also the fact that these religious communities are intentionally together in person regularly. Mm-hmm. And so you get a built-in community. Kids growing up in this kind of community have built-in relationships in person together. And that, I mean, he talked in the entire book about how in-person relationships and community are a huge factor in avoiding anxiety and depression. Mm-hmm. And he also talks about how just religion itself is an insulating factor. And I think we would all agree to that, I mean, there is just a different level of managing anxiety and depression when you have church, when you have prayer, when you have a faith community, when you have, you just have an entirely different tool set of things that you can do and ways that you can manage anxiety and depression when you're in a religious community. Not to mention the fact that we believe the Holy Spirit is always with us. And so we're never alone, right? And so even in loneliness, we know that Jesus is always with us. And so it's just an entirely different perspective. So I was just finding this, I mean, I'm still like processing, but I'm just finding it very interesting and also a bit of hope, I think, because there's a lot of this book that's really like panic inducing. I'm like, oh no, this is, I mean, it's a huge problem. And like, oh, we all have to do something about it. But I think for a lot of families in conservative religious communities, which I think a lot of our listeners are, like, we're already doing a lot of the right things. We're already doing a lot of this, of the things that he's talking about, like to raise kids in a way that is going to help insulate them against the terrible effects of smartphones and social media that he's talking about. So I think injecting a little bit of hope into this, that like, we don't necessarily need to be like, oh, the world's on fire. And
no,
there's already a community that a lot of us are a part of, and just leaning into that a little bit more and being more, even maybe just being more intentional about when there's youth group, all the phones go away, or just like small tweaks that maybe not that difficult to do that will just really help boost the kids that were around.
And I think we already have a theological framework for dealing with this that is a lot deeper than anything he has to work with. I mean, he talks about us being embodied, but we can talk about incarnational, you know, sacramental, this idea that, you know, virtual church is not the same as worship in the fellowship of believers in their bodies. With the body and blood of Christ.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we've always sort of grasped that there's a difference between real and virtual, and that real is better.
Yeah.
And that virtual is no substitute for real. And I think the more we can just sort of lean into that, and that's where this book, I think, has been a really great gift for me, coming out of it going, I'm not crazy.
Yeah.
I'm not alone. This really is a problem. There really are solutions. And, you know, the panic inducingness of it is kind of occasionally irritating, but more, I think, helpful, because that panic spurs us on with a sense of urgency to actually make the changes that need to happen. I mean, you know how people are. If the house is not on fire, you're not going to run outside. And so the tone of the house is on fire in this book, well, yes, you're right. It might have been amped up a little bit here and there. I think there was a strategy there to try to make sure that nobody doesn't take it seriously enough to actually do some of the real, possible, hope-inducing things that can make life better for our children, but also for ourselves. Because it definitely applies to all of us. I liked especially what he said in the very, very last, it wasn't even the last chapter, more the epilogue, bring childhood back to earth. He said the two things that we can and all should do, speak up, which we're doing right now, by the way, we're talking about this book, and just talk about your experiences, talk about your concerns. We don't have to say this is normal, this is the way humanity will be from here on out. And the other thing he says is to link up. Says, if you're a parent, connect with other parents who value play-based childhood and more childhood independence. And he gives some ideas for how to do that. But we would just say, yeah, let's link up with families from church.
Right.
And find ways to make sure that our children have these in-person, real, physical relationship experiences that are going to be the best insulation from the loneliness, the isolation, the despair, the spiritual vulnerability that comes from a screen-based childhood. Speak up, link up. That's not hard. We can do that, right?
Yeah. I think one of the biggest questions I have now is just as adults who care for children, like, what do we do? Like, he has tons of suggestions and helpful hints and like very specific prescriptive ways.
I know, right?
For kids, like what to do about the kids and the teenagers and encouraging them. I'm also like, what about all of the parents and all of the adults? Because especially like millennials, I mean, I basically am attached to my phone. So, and I don't like it, but wait, I don't know what to do about it.
You already said this book is long and dense, and now you're like, make it longer and denser.
I need the epilogue part two for adults.
You know, I was, as I was reading it, I was struck by similar sentiment, and it made me, I was like, I'm going to just look and see what sort of things are options in my phone that for like certain settings that I could just put up. And I decided that I was going to try one that I would schedule that on Sundays I'm not going to make it so that it doesn't notify. I already despise notifications. Yeah. So much. Yes. Guys, I mean, I'm legendary for it. But anyway, nobody gets to push notifications at me except like actual texts. And even those, I don't get that many of those. But I decided that on Sundays, I was going to make my phone be grayscale.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
I love that.
So that it would be like a little reminder. Hey, do you really want to be on your phone today? Maybe today is a good day to take a break. I can still look at it, but it's like an immediate visual reminder of, wait a second. So I just set up that little schedule on my phone that on Sundays from, you know, the morning to the night or whatever, I don't remember what exactly I set it as, but I could still open my phone and look at anything, but it would all show up in grayscale.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to experiment with that and see how that does for me.
Mm-hmm. App timers, yeah. I will say app timers, I think they're different on Android and iOS. And I have heard that iOS is a lot easier to work around, which is kind of annoying. But
yes,
app
it
timers,
is. It's too easy.
App timers have been really a game changer to curb my social media use because I use the time. And when it's done, the app grays out. I don't get notifications. I can't go into it unless I go through like three steps to go into my settings and change it, which sometimes I do. But I mean, that is something I guess I shouldn't be all Debbie Downer. I mean, there are some things I have been trying.
Yeah. Like, and it's the little things and sharing your hack. Like Aaron, I would never have thought of that grayscale on Sunday thing, but I think I'm going to try it. My little things is I don't do social media on my phone. I don't have a Facebook app. If I get a notification and I don't get many, but like, you know, we have a constant thread going in Facebook Messenger, the three of us, that has been running for, 6 years now? Yeah. I know we're the reason you hate notifications, Aaron.
Sorry.
But if there's something that needs my attention, I will take my phone, I will walk over to a laptop, I will pull up. And, you know, adding those moments of tension really helps. I have YouTube on my phone, but it was becoming a time suck. So I took the little icon for the YouTube app. And I put it not only on the fourth page, but I put it in the extras folder on like the fifth page of extras.
You have to really dig for
it. Oh my goodness. If I want to do YouTube, I've got to flip, 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 push, flip, 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 put there. And so I've got to really, it just, it's about increasing those moments of friction for me.
Yeah.
And maybe by the time I'm done flipping through all those pages, I'll think, maybe I don't need to watch YouTube that bad.
Right. Yeah. Like if I only have 30 minutes of time on Facebook, do I really want to just mindlessly scroll? Probably not. I probably want to actually engage in the conversations that I meant to engage in. And also on my, so this is not my phone, but just curbing social media use in general. A lot of time I was leaving a Facebook browser open because I do social media for my job. And so like,
I know I used to, I don't now. And I don't think I will ever say yes to doing it again.
Yes, it is one of the least favorite parts of my job. And people already know that. So that's nothing new. But I realized I was leaving it all open also because I have ongoing Messenger chats with like you guys and my friends or whatever. But I realized I could open just Messenger in a browser, not Facebook, but just Messenger.com and close the big Facebook.
That's new. I didn't know you could do that.
I know. I randomly came to my brain one day that I should try doing that. And so I still have my conversations because I need to be able to talk to people. But I have to actively go open another browser if I want to access big Facebook. And because the thing that I access the most big on that Facebook. On my work computer is the Ladies Lounge Facebook group. If I just type in FAC in my URL browser thing, it's the lounge that pops up first.
The best place on Facebook, probably the only worthwhile place on Facebook.
So like that, just doing that on my work computer has drastically reduced how much time, because like I sit and edit audio and like you have to wait for stuff and wait for things. And so I like browse for 3 minutes, but I'm like, that's just a waste of my time.
And your brain.
And my brain.
Yeah. Like, I do it too. I'm not judging.
Right. Like, I mean, it's just, it's a thing a lot of us do, but I don't do that anymore because I have to actually make the effort to go to the big Facebook. So like there's just little, those little hacks like you're saying of just creating some separation and like just that pause of like, do I actually want to scroll right now?
Right.
Maybe not. Maybe I should do something else.
I think we need to remember that we're adults.
Right.
Like, we're adults. We're addicted. But we see the problem. Mm-hmm. And we have the executive function, the mature reasoning to be like, okay, let me make some incremental changes. Let me talk with my friends, get some ideas, and implement those and really try to stick with it. Teenagers don't have that much executive function.
Yeah. Right.
Yep. And they need us to lead the way. So one thing that I've tried to do, and I'm surprised he didn't mention this more, I guess because he was really not focusing as much on parents, except for what policies we can do. But one thing that I've tried to do with my children is to think out loud as I'm engaging with my phone, you know, and be like, and so they will actually, I will be like, I'm really trying to use this less. And they will call me on it. They'll be like, Mom, put your phone down.
Good.
Or, you know, I'm just very vocal about my relationship with my phone. I can't believe I've been browsing Amazon for the last 20 minutes. Somebody stop me. Okay, Mom, I'll stop you. You know, if you can be honest and open about our own struggles and let them witness how we are thinking through any problematic usage and then what we're trying to do to fix it and then loop them into the solution, then they sort of get to walk alongside us as we, as adults, think through our relationship with these devices. And maybe that will help them to do it better than we do it.
Yeah. Modeling behavior. It's huge. Mm-hmm.
All right. Any last thoughts before we close the book on The Anxious Generation?
No, it's a very thought-provoking one.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it.
I appreciate having a new perspective on parenting and teenagers.
Yeah.
Since I think I have neither of those.
I needed it. And so thank you for coming alongside me as I walked through this book, because I think it has been a bit of a game changer in my own mind and given me the conviction that I need to do things that I kind of knew that I needed to do anyway. Mm. And so here we go.
Yeah.
All right. The Anxious Generation. That was our nonfiction read for the spring. But I think we need something a little lighter.
Yes.
And maybe a little more fictional.
Yep.
And definitely a little more faith-based.
Yeah.
For the summer. And spoiler alert, all three of us decided 3 weeks ago what we were going to do.
I already bought it right away that day.
And everyone thought this was a fun idea. So those of you who have been anxiously waiting for our next book club pick, which we will be reading together, I believe, in July, we decided we wanted to do something light and perfectly on brand as Lutheran ladies. And also we wanted to loop in young people because it's youth gathering this summer.
It is.
And spoiler alert, we're planning something really youth friendly in the summer to celebrate the fact of 20,000 young people getting together and loving being Lutheran together.
Mm-hmm. And we do love a summer series on the podcast.
We love a summer series. So our book club for July, we are dubbing Bring a Teen to Book Club.
Yes.
And each one of us, just like in Finding Nemo, when the sharks have to bring a friend to their their fish of friends, not food group. Each of us is going to bring a young chum, a Lutheran lady, a young Lutheran lady to book club and encourage her to join. So we will have a very full studio in July when we talk about this. Mm-hmm. I've already recruited my Lutheran lady because she lives with me.
I'm trying to decide who to ask.
Okay. Well, if you really want to be somebody's bring a teen to book club chum.
Yeah.
You know, shoot us a message or something and we'll see what we can do. But we are going to be reading a classic work of Lutheran ladiness that comes up occasionally and we've never done it yet. So it's about time. Mm. Are you ready? Drum roll. Join us in July for E. Jane Maule's Kitty My Rib.
Yeah.
The heartwarming story of a woman of courage and devotion. This is a warm, fictionalized telling of the life of Katie Luther and her marriage to Martin Luther. It's very romantic.
Oh boy.
Not terrifically.
How old is this book?
This book was written, I want to say, in the
my mom's bookshelf.
Yes, 1959. I was correct.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh man. And I read it once years ago, and I remember coming out of it basically going, "Aw." I don't remember much more of it than that. But I know that for a lot of our older Lutheran women, this book is one that you have read, that you have loved, and probably would enjoy reading again. And so we're giving you this opportunity not only to read it again, but to share it with a teenage Lutheran lady in your life.
Yes.
Fair warning, I'm not sure it is 100% actually accurate because it's a fictionalized retelling. Mm-hmm. So don't think of it as like a history book. Think of it as an inspirational, fictionalized version of the story and enjoy the ride. It will not be as dense as The Anxious Generation for anyone who got stuck in the middle of that one. It should be a nice, light summer read. I already have my copy. I'm looking forward to it. And my daughter will be joining us in studio in July for this experience. So welcome, young Lutheran lady readers, to book club.
This is going to be really fun. I'm excited. I've never read this before.
Really?
Okay. Really. I know it was popular when I was a teenager, or at least some of my friends read it, but I didn't read as much as I thought I did when I was a kid. Apparently, I read a lot of American Girl and National Geographic and not a lot of other stuff. So I'm really looking forward to this. Yeah. It's going to be really fun. I already bought my copy, but it is currently on my bookshelf until I finish grad school, which is very soon. So
very soon. Very
then I get soon. To read fun things over the summer, like Kitty My Rib. This is going to be very fun. So, ladies, join us in July for Kitty My Rib and bring your teenagers along. This is going to be a really fun book club. Bring in the kids along. And you can join us in our Facebook group. Book club happens asynchronously as an event on Facebook. So Rachel posts questions and then everybody answers them. And it's fun and very low key, low stress. So
yes. I really can't do anything else.
It's true. We like low-key, low stress. So join us there in our Facebook group. And also book club typically happens on Instagram the week after the podcast, because then I can post the questions and then conversation can happen on Instagram as well. So if you're not on Facebook, only on Instagram, there is still opportunity for you to chime in on these books, maybe more popular with the teenagers anyway, on Instagram. So that will also happen on Instagram. And same thing with this podcast, The Anxious Generation. Those questions will also be posted on Instagram once this podcast drops. So if you have additional commentary, the event is still in our Facebook group. If you want to go back in and comment on any of those posts, if you accidentally forgot that it happened, like I know some people did, because it's April and almost Holy Week and here we are. Or you can go on our Instagram and comment there as well. You can find all of our episodes at KFUO.org/Lutheran Ladies Lounge or on your favorite podcasting app or on the KFUO radio app. You're listening to the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast. I'm Sarah.
I'm Erin.
And I'm Rachel. And we sound like we're just about dead.
I know.
We're
all so sick.
I'm sorry.
I really did enjoy the book.
And I'm trying not to cough.
All right, go to bed, people.
Views and opinions expressed on the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast may not represent the official position of the management or ownership of KFUO Radio, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. The Lutheran Ladies Lounge is produced by KFUO Radio and available at KFUO.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button and leave a review for us too. If you love the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast, consider financially supporting our producer, KFUO Radio, so we can keep doing what we do. Find out how at KFUO.org/give.
Okay, I'm just going to let that roll. Probably not an outtake. It's not funny, but that's okay.
Before we get going.
Yes.
I spent way too much time in the course of this researching to find out if the narrator of the audiobook has like two different names that he narrates under. like one for nonfiction and one for fiction, because I was certain that I had heard his voice before. Sounds very much like the guy that narrates one of my favorite sci-fi series. And so I did a lot of digging, but then I found separate pictures for each of them, and they are definitely not the same person.
It's a vocal doppelganger situation.
Yeah. That's all.
Okay, here we go.